Hi there, dolls, music lovers, and fashion enthusiasts. Welcome to season 2 of Unveiling the Legends, Dolls of the 60s and 70s, the podcast that takes you on a groovy journey through the lives and legacies of the incredible women who shaped these iconic decades. We are your hosts, Emma
and Abby,
and together we'll explore the stories behind the music, the fashion, and the cultural revolution that defined an era.
Each episode will shine a spotlight on a remarkable woman, from rock and roll rebels to fashion icons, and dive into their impact on the world. We'll uncover the historical context, chat with experts, and celebrate the lasting influence of these trailblazing ladies. So, grab your bell bottoms and get ready to rock and roll as we uncover the untold stories of dolls who left their mark. Let's dive in!
So how have you been? Happy New Year, Yay! Everybody. It's a new year, a new season. I hope everyone had a great start.
Oh, the holidays were crazy.
Yes.
I'm still slowly undecorating.
Yeah, me too.
No time.
No, we still have our Christmas tree and everything up. We only came home once and I like dumped my dirty laundry and packed new clothes and that was it.
Isn't that how it is?
Yeah.
Oh god, after the new year, I just had a pile of laundry up to here. It was so bad.
I feel like it's always like that. And I heard, I don't know if that's like a myth that people tell, but here it's really common. People tell you to not do laundry between years. Because apparently it's for bad luck if you like dry your laundry, especially outside. That's apparently bad luck for the new year. But I did that, so I hope I don't have bad luck this year.
I'm superstitious about that stuff. There's a saying, I guess, here that if you sweep on New Year's, you sweep out all the good luck. So I don't sweep. But by then, I'm so busy from the holidays that Buddy's hair is just everywhere and I want so badly to vacuum, but I can't. I don't know. It's been pretty eventful for the both of us since last season, our first season. You did your Vlogmas, which was just such a great idea, going through the 60s and 70s by year. It's so original.
Thank you.
Really, round of applause for that, because that's no easy undertaking. I did a little bit of double album Decembering.
I adored that.
Which kind of, it spiraled a little bit out of control there. Oh gosh. I was on the ZappaCast.
That is so, so cool. You have to tell me everything.
I still can't believe that happened. And I'm so bummed that Joe Travers was sick that day, because I did really want to talk with him about the ZappaVolt and if there's any GTOs in there. Hint, hint.
We have to find that out in some sort of way. It hasn't even been that long since we stopped the last season, but it's just a very eventful time, I guess.
Yes. I did see A Complete Unknown and I had a great time. I think it was a little corny, but it was still a great time. And Edward Norton as Pete Seeger stole the show. He was incredible.
My big thing is, when you do a biopic, you always have to kind of like decide on a directorial direction, I guess. And I feel like this biopic is very much told from the outside. And I would have loved for this to be a little more insight into Bob Dylan as a person, because I feel like it was told with a lot of distance.
It captured Dylan the enigma more than Dylan the person, which is honestly exactly what Bob Dylan would want.
Yeah.
All he has out there really is Chronicles Volume 1, and, you know, he's been known to tell some tall tales about his life, so it was interesting to separate out what was real and what was fiction and how effectively the two were blended, because that was very Bob.
I just put out a video today, actually, about the fashion of the film, because that was a really interesting aspect to me. When I watched A Great Unknown, I was like, man, this looks very authentic to me. Like, the fashion is really well done. And then I read this article that Ariane Phillips was interviewed in. She did the costumes, and she also did the costumes for another one of my favorite films set in the 60s, Walk the Line.
Nice.
It's the same director, too, and I was like, okay, so she knew where she was coming from. But then she also did the costumes for Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, which I'm like torn on the costume choices, to say the least. Mm-hmm. But she actually said in this interview that the way that they achieved this very authentic wardrobe is that they mixed the styles. So half of the wardrobe is exact replicas of what they wore. And then the other half is original vintage pieces from the 60s and 70s. And I feel like that's why it feels so authentic.
That's a good blend.
I really love that. It's a smart move.
I loved the green polka dot shirt and the gag with Al Cooper stealing it. Yes. That was fantastic.
I had a good time.
Me too.
And then unfortunately, yesterday, Peter Yarrow of Peter, Paul and Mary passed. And I got very emotional, which I did not expect, because when people ask me about my favorite band, Peter, Paul and Mary never comes to mind. But I listened to them a lot. And so it really hit me when he passed, leaving on a jet plane.
Oh.
That is so beautiful. And I like listened to it. Like I heard about his passing and then I put it on. And I cried so hard because it's like, it gets this whole new meaning of like literally leaving and like you're gone now. It made me really appreciative of the fact that even though he's gone now, we still have his music.
Mm-hmm. It makes you cherish the icons we have around still even more. Like we gotta rap Bob Dylan and Paul McCartney in bubble wrap.
Today we are talking about a band that we have talked about a lot, both here and on both of our YouTube channels. A band that is very synonymous with the 1960s, but we're going to talk about a woman associated with them. I got very excited when I saw the script that Abby sent, and I'm so happy to be back with this incredible episode. Take it away, Abby.
I'm really excited too. In my Beatle books, she's only mentioned tangentially, if at all. So when this film was sent my way, I was super excited and I kind of filed it away in my list of ladies I would like to cover. Okay. When we think of underrated women in the Beatles world, wives and girlfriends usually come to mind. Maureen Starkey, Cynthia Lennon, or Jane Asher. Some might name Apple Corps secretary Chris O'Dell, or maybe photographer and friend of the band Astrid Kircher. So sorry if I mispronounced that. I do not speak German.
It's hard. It's Kircher.
Oh.
And I feel like that's really hard to say for people who don't speak German.
If you ask me, our first doll of season two is truly the most underrated Beatle girl and has serious grounds to claim the esteemed title of the Beatles' biggest fan. She stumbled upon the band in their early days when they were still just scruffy lads from Liverpool. As their secretary and fan club president, a job coveted by millions of girls at the height of Beatlemania, she followed them to the toppermost of the poppermost and through the bitter end. Though the Beatles were only together as we know them for 10 years, this legendary lady worked for them for 11. But what if I told you this friend, trusted confidant, and highest-ranking woman in Fab Four HQ was just a teenager when she got her start? This is the incredible true story of good old Frida Kelly. This episode wouldn't have been possible without the only definitive account of Frida's life so far, Ryan White's Good Ol' Frida documentary, and loyal listener Pat Reeder for tipping me off to this little-known film. It's available for free on Tubi in the US as of us posting this. If you can find the DVD, you absolutely should. There's deleted scenes of Frida talking about her appearance on Jukebox Jury in 64, and the after-party for the premiere of How I Won the War. The soundtrack is great, too. It's not just the Beatles. It's all of the early 60s stuff we love. Like, I think there's a little bit of Cliff Richard. There is definitely Some Kind of Wonderful by the Drifters. Great music choices. Frida, though, absolutely makes it worth the watch. She is such a sweetheart. And I hope you enjoy this film, too.
Frida Kelly was born on July 14th in 1945 in Dublin, Ireland. When she was just 18 months old, her mother passed away of cancer. Frida was the only child of her mother and her father, now a single parent. Her father was a hard-working and practical man, but strict and intensely protective. He would have done anything for his little girl. So when his daughter was 13, he moved them to Liverpool, England, in search of a new life. To the Irish Examiner, Frida said, in quotes, "My stepmother, although she was Irish, lived a long long time in England and had relations there, so there was always a connection, and I think it was my stepmother who really wanted to move back. It took a while for Frida to get used to the life in the new country, but in the late 1950s and early 60s, England was changing. A rebellious youth culture was about to explode. Soon, Frida was 16, and it came time for her to go and get her first job. Have you ever seen a movie or a TV show of an old-timey office where there's rows and rows of ladies at typewriters? They were called typing pools. That's where Frida worked. As a secretary for Simpson, Roberts & Co., she typed up letters, contracts, or whatever the higher-up men in the office handed down. She was far removed from normalized office shenanigans like in Mad Men, but it was one of the few jobs she could have had at the time. Women were only just entering the workforce in the early 1960s, and Frida took pride in being a working woman. One day, two guys from the office came down and invited her to lunch. She didn't know where she was going or what her plans were, but in office culture in those days, if higher-up invited you out as a girl, you didn't say no. Lunch was a couple of minutes away from the office, an unassuming basement spot. Plastered to the outside were signs welcoming visitors and boasting of swinging lunchtime sessions from noon to 2:15 on weekdays. Frida and her co-workers arrived at one of these lunchtime sessions and descended into the Cavern Club. There she first laid eyes on four young men with leather jackets and matching haircuts: John Lennon, Paul McCartney, George Harrison, and Pete Best. They would soon be known worldwide as the Beatles. Bésame mucho. Each time I cling to your kiss, I hear music divine. So bésame, bésame mucho. I'll love you forever, say that you'll always be mine. Cha-cha-boom. It's hard to believe nowadays, but once upon a time, the Cavern Club was just a humble hangout in Liverpool. Emphasis on humble. It was once a fruit market. It reeked of rotting fruit, clogged toilets, and BO. It was so hot and humid in the club that girls would show up with their hair still in rollers and wait to take them out until before the guys were on stage. Dreamcoat certainly didn't exist in the 60s, and Dippity-Doo didn't come on the market until 1965. There was only so much you could do to beat the heat. I cannot imagine how it felt in there.
What would I have done in the early 60s? Seriously. Yeah. I would last about 5 minutes, and then when I get outside, I start to sweat. So the hair just slowly creeps up until...
Yeah.
Seriously, what did curly-haired girls do back
then? Maybe like a scarf tied up in your hair? I don't know. I can just only imagine the fact that it like smells rotten and then it's really hot and damp and then everyone's smoking.
Oh, I forgot about that. Yeah. Everybody smoked indoors.
When you look at old pictures of the Cavern Club, you can never see the ceiling because it is filled with smoke. So I feel like it must have been insane going in there. And I feel like it is so wild to go in there in like your office wear on a regular Wednesday or something.
Yeah.
That is an interesting hangout spot for like a lunch meeting. Hot, sweaty, and kind of gross was the perfect place for the Beatles in 1961. They'd just come back to Liverpool after a turn in Hamburg. Promoters in Germany realized booking bands from Liverpool were much cheaper than bands from London. So the Beatles were part of a wave of bands invading the Hamburg club circuit. In quote, "We were a promoter's dream," Paul said in Anthology. "We were told, you can go to Hamburg and get £15 a week. Now, £15 a week was more than my dad earned. In fact, the teachers at school didn't make more than that. It was a no-brainer. Of course, the guys dropped out of school to make more than their teachers." It was a wild time of music and debauchery. John famously said in an interview, "I grew up in Hamburg, not Liverpool. The days and nights were grueling. The guys took uppers to make it through hour-long sets. They slept in room closets, dingy hostels, or on the floors of the clubs they played, as they couldn't afford anything else." I have actually been to Hamburg several times. You can do like these Beatle tours, and I've never done one, but like I made my own notes to like visit all the places, and there's this one sort of famous spot close to the Star Club where they started out, and it used to be an old cinema, and they were allowed to sleep in the back room. And I always imagined, okay, it's like the back room of a house. But no, it's like a wooden barn. I read in like a couple of biographies that the slits between the wood pieces on the floor were like this thick, like a couple of centimeters, and that they had to be super careful to not drop their things because it would literally fall through the floor and then it would have been gone. So that is so wild.
No, but like your wallet, if you drop your wallet between those, toast. Toast, yeah. You're never getting it back.
The smell of the cavern must not have bothered the guys too much, as they once slept among a pool of George's vomit he refused to clean up. It grew fuzz. That is insane. They called it the thing. That is such a guy's thing. Yes. I'm sorry, but it's like, it's such a typical teenage guy thing.
It just seems like a frat house to me.
Yes. George may or may not reference it in the movie Help.
Hey, it's a thingy. A fiendish thingy.
The Beatles made waves at the local scene, playing haunts like the Star Club, the Indra, and the Kaiserkeller. The party was over in October of 1960 when Paul engaged in a little mischief. He lit a condom on fire and was charged with attempted arson.
Again, such a guy thing.
Why would you even do that?
I guess it was because the owner of whatever club they were sleeping in stiffed them, or it was some kind of breach of contract, so Paul just did the first thing he could think of. He nailed a condom to the wall and lit it on fire.
I love that. On top of that, authorities found out George was lying about his age. You had to be 18 to play the clubs in Hamburg, but George was only 17 at the time. Thus, the band was unceremoniously ejected from the country. Pete and his mom had to harass the club owner to get the guy's gear back. I love the idea of his mom being there. Original bassist Stuart Sutcliffe decided to stay in Germany, and after a few fill-ins, Paul switched to his new signature instrument.
The Beatles began their run at the Cavern Club in February 1961. Of their 300 shows at the Cavern, Frida estimates she saw 290. She showed up late to work nearly every day, stinking of the cavern, having been there day and night to see the boys. In that time, she got to know them. She called Paul first because her friend had a crush on him. He was the extrovert of the band, always friendly and taking every song request he could. John was, quote, a man of many moods. He could be grumpy at times. When he wasn't out of sorts, he was a lot of fun to be around. Though he was the fearless leader, he leaned on Paul. Without his glasses on, John couldn't see much past the palm of his hand. George was 18 years old at the time, closest in age to Frida. He wasn't the quiet Beatle, but she remembers him being thoughtful and kind. He could ham it up on stage, too. One of his signature numbers was the Sheik of Araby. He'd do a little dance and often change the lyrics to the Sheik of Wavertree as a shout to his birthplace. Well, I'm the Sheik. As for Pete, though he was the true shy one, he was the fan favorite. The girls loved him and screamed for him the most. In 1961, the Beatles met Brian Epstein. He was the manager of the record department at his family's business, North End Music Stores. Frida got to know him through the Cavern Club scene. He went to see the Beatles just about as much as she did. He was the polar opposite of the rowdy band, well-mannered and sharply dressed. Brian was sophisticated and had business know-how the young band just didn't. Some might describe him as posh. Though he was just 27 years old at the time, Epi was like a father figure to the young band, as was his father, Harry, or Daddy Epi. Quote, "The Beatles called Brian Epi, we all did, but to his face, he asked us to call him Mr. Brian in the office." Epi dressed the Beatles in matching collarless suits, giving them a more family-friendly image. He negotiated ownership of the tapes of the Beatles' failed audition for Decca Records and landed them a deal with Parlophone. One Saturday, at a booking, Epi mentioned he'd signed the Beatles and was starting his own firm. He asked Frida if she would like to be his assistant. He wanted a fan for the job, but not an over-the-top screaming fangirl. He knew Frida could get the job done while having the passion and love for the guys to act in their best interest. "Oh, come on then," she said. "Surely this was a joke. Working for her favorite band was something totally beyond her imagination." She was so sure Brian wasn't serious that she didn't respond to him until Monday. But it wasn't a joke. Frida had just landed her dream job. Working for the Beatles wasn't very glamorous at first. Though Nems became one of the biggest record shops in North England under Brian's managership, Frida's office was just a storage closet upstairs. The lack of space wasn't much trouble, though. The firm, as she calls it, was just Eppy, her, and a second assistant, Beryl Adams, at the time. Frida's father steeply disapproved of her new job. He'd seen the Beatles once in their Teddy Boy era, with pompadours, scruffy facial hair, and leather jackets. He didn't want his precious daughter anywhere near rock and roll. But it was no use. You can't stop stubborn teenagers. Frida had no idea how to tell him she was working for the Beatles. She didn't want to lie to her father, but she didn't want to tell the truth either, so when asked, she said nothing, leaving Dad to put two and two together on his own. Keeping your mouth shut instead of outright lying to your dad is slightly better. Believe it or not, we were both teenage girls once, and we speak from experience. But it still won't end well.
No, it never does.
Again, you can't stop teenagers. Knowing his daughter would have a well-paying job at just 17 years old, her dad did allow her to keep the position. However, as we'll see later on, it'd be on his terms. Around the same time she met Eppy, Frida met the first president of the Beatles' official fan club, Roberta Brown. Frida didn't really understand why the guys had a fan club. They were only a local group. But when Roberta got a boyfriend and lost interest in running the club, Frida stepped up to the plate. Little did she know this would change her life forever. On the Beatles' side of things, there were some serious shakeups ahead. Having not been able to keep up, Pete Best was dismissed as drummer. It was very messy. Not only did poor Pete get fired, but friend of the band Neil Aspinall fathered a child with Pete's mom! Around the same time, John's girlfriend, Cynthia Powell, discovered she was pregnant. They hastily married, with Eppy arranging a small ceremony, frequently interrupted by building renovations. Though Julian was born in April of 1963, Eppy kept John's marriage a secret for as long as he possibly could. The band would be a lot more marketable to girls if the guys appeared single. Despite the drama, of which there was a lot, Frida welcomed new drummer Richard Starkey with open arms. He'd soon be known and loved worldwide as Ringo Starr. Beatles fans didn't like Ringo at first. They booed him and chanted for Pete to come back. Frida tried to help ease him in, but of course she was victim to the guy's practical jokes. In a Q&A promoting the good old Frida film, she told the story of some friendly public humiliation. Quote, "A few months after Ringo joined the band, I went to see them perform in a theater, and before I went to see them, I decided I was going to shout a request to Ringo to sing Boys. But I didn't know that someone had already told them I was going to do that. I was shouting it out for Ringo because he was not getting as many requests as the other three. But when I did shout the request, Ringo knew it was me, stood up from his drum set, and he told me, 'Oh, sit down, Kelly.' So I didn't come out from my seat until the show ended out of embarrassment." Frida didn't have a favorite Beatle. She was young. She had a crush on whoever paid attention to her that day. Quote, "If Paul looked nice or sang a song for me or something, then I was in love with Paul that day. But then the following day, if Richie," like the guys she always called Ringo Richie, "asked me how me dogs were, I'd think, 'Oh yeah, I fancy Richie.' And then I think if George offered me a lift home from work, well, I'd be in love with George that day." Don't worry, she didn't leave John out. She loved his voice and thought his nose was cute. But Frida always had a soft spot for Ringo. He got the least amount of fan mail and got attacked the most by crazed fans. Though Frida was close to all the Beatles families, going dancing with the Harrisons and even getting drunk with her Uncle Joe, that's Paul's father, Frida was closest to Ringo's mom, Elsie. She invited Frida over every week for a meal and to chat. She became Frida's mother figure. In 1962, Ringo began seeing hairdresser Maureen Cox. Of course, she and Frida were fast friends too.
The Beatles' Meteoric Rise began that year with the release of Love Me Do. Much to the guys' delight, it charted. It was a strong enough start for a new bang among steep competition like Cliff Richard. While America was busy spinning Connie Francis, Pat Boone, the Everly Brothers, and Elvis Presley, they were blissfully unaware of the Beatles. Pop radio, as we know it today, didn't really exist in England in 1962. It would still be a couple of years before Wonderful Radio London set sail. All they really had at this time was Radio Luxembourg, broadcasting out of the country of the same name. Even though she didn't have a record player, Frida bought a copy of Love Me Do. Lots of other girls did the same, buying the single just to boost sales. Love Me Do was a good enough debut to warrant the Beatles landing a spot on the Little Richard show at the Empire Theater. This was huge for the guys. Little Richard was Paul's idol. He co-opted Little Richard's famous woo and head bob. Gonna tell Aunt Mary about Uncle John. He claimed he has a misery, but he's having a lot of fun. Oh, baby. Yes, baby. Woo, baby. Having me some fun tonight. Yeah. Well, long, tall, Sally, she built a species guy. Everything that Uncle John need. Oh, baby. Yes, baby. Woo. When Love Me Do was first released in September of 1962, it was only a modest hit, peaking at number 17 on the charts for only a week. But it still brought in lots of new fans. For fan mail, Frida innocently gave out her and her dad's home address. What a mistake this was. The morning after the fan club published their address, Frida woke up to a knock on her door. It was the mailman with a bundle of 200 letters for the Beatles. In the following month, as they released From Me to You, the bundles became bags and the bags became sacks. Responding to it all was a great undertaking. Frida would work from 9 in the morning to 5 at night, responding to letters overnight, and somehow still found time to see the Beatles. Now letters came to the Kelly home in full trucks. Remember, mixed in with all that fan mail was the Kellys' bills. If Frida's dad wasn't keen on the Beatles before, he definitely wasn't now. He put his foot down and the fan mail address was changed to Eppie's office. As the Beatles' star rose in 1963, so did the stature of Frida's job. President of the fan club became a daunting task, as the guys had more and more girls vying for their affection, and therefore their signatures. After the guys' first number one hit, Please Please Me, Frida lost count of how many letters came in. Assistants would just throw them in the corner of her office for her to reply to. It was so chaotic, they had to move the office from above NEMS to Liverpool's business district. Among Frida's fan club and office responsibilities were handling the Beatles' allowances, collecting £200 split across four envelopes from the bank and delivering them each week. There was a lot of work to be done every day, so whoever dropped by the office, whether they were girls trying to meet the Beatles or members of other bands, Frida would put them to work, and she could boss people around. At just 18 years old, she was the highest-ranking woman in the Beatles' world, from performance to criticism, management, and everything in between. The music industry is still largely a boys' club. It was even more so a boys' club in the mid-1960s. The only way you could make it to the top was by working for the guy at the top. And that was Frida, assistant to the boss, Mr. Brian. Though she looked quite young and was naive for her age, Frida was still respected in the office, in quotes. She had this way about her, said Bill Kinsley of the Mercy Beats. A bit like a schoolteacher, really. You had to do what the schoolteacher said. I love when someone so young is so confident. That's always great.
1964 was the year the Beatles really kicked off. On February 7th, the Fab Four touched down in America. 2 days later, they'd change rock and roll history forever with their first appearance on The Ed Sullivan Show. Oh yeah, I'll tell you something. I think you'll understand. I want to hold your hand. I want to hold your hand. I want to hold your hand. Oh, please say to me, you let me be your man. And please say to me, you let me hold your hand. Beatlemania had officially begun. You can see it in the 8 Days a Week and recent Beatles 64 documentary. Girls screamed, fainted, and cried over the Beatles in adorable New York accents. They chased after their cars, chased after them, even snuck into their hotels to try and find their rooms. These fans were, and still are, written off as hysterical teenage girls in the media. Quote, "A lot of people didn't take these girls seriously, but I did," Frida said.
"I don't care what anybody thinks. I love the Beatles for them, and I'll always love them. Even when I'm 105 and an old grandmother, I'll love them. And Paul McCartney, if you are listening, Adrian from Brooklyn loves you with all her heart."
However, she didn't get to partake in this herself. While select staff, including Neil Aspinall and beloved Beatle roadie and sidekick Mal Evans, could travel with the guys, Frida stayed behind at the office. This was nearly a decade before Chris O'Dell became one of the first female rock and roll tour managers. Unless you were in a girl group like the Ronettes, it wasn't proper for women to be on the road in the 60s. Epi soon decided it was time to move the firm to London. The Beatles were simply too big for Liverpool now. Frida was thrilled. London was the big city. She looked for apartments in the papers and got excited over all the clubs she'd finally get to go to. She happily told her father she was moving one night over dinner. Her father, now falling ill, forbade it. Knowing how wild the city and the rock and roll world were, he wanted to protect his baby girl as long as he possibly could. Frida tearfully handed in her notice to Epi's office the next morning. But after a talk with the guys, Epi said she wasn't allowed to quit. He had a long talk with her father, too, and they worked out an arrangement for her. She still wasn't allowed to move to London, but every 6 weeks she could visit. This way, she could still oversee some operations in the main office and keep her job in Liverpool. It was a good thing she kept her job. At the height of Beatlemania, the guys got somewhere between 2 and 3,000 letters a day. Membership of the official Beatles fan club swelled to 40,000 members. Other fan clubs cropped up all over the world, but Frida's was the biggest. Fan requests got more and more outrageous. Girls sent locks of hair, directions to their homes in hopes the guys would come to their birthday parties, or their pillowcases asking for their favorite Beatle to sleep on. Frida even housed an American fan in her own home for a week before tracking down her family in London. About wild requests, Frida said, "If I could have, I would have done it too, because I was a fan myself. I knew where they were coming from." Likewise, there were simply too many autograph requests to keep up with, so the office resorted to using autograph stamps. Both Frida and John were strongly against this, but the demand was so high and the guys' schedules so busy, they didn't have a choice. Inevitably, the stamps would smudge. As the world caught Beatlemania, headlines hailed Frida as having the most coveted job in the world. There were even rumors she'd secretly married Paul. I actually have some of those, like, little Beatles cards.
I love that.
From the 60s, that their signatures were stamped onto. I have some of these. They were a Christmas gift.
Oh, that's so sweet. I feel like even the stamps are so much more than what a band does nowadays. Mm. I don't know if any band still has a fan club like this, where you could just send a letter and they will send back autographs or stamps or pictures or something. The amount of work and the undertaking it took, and also the fact that Epi was okay with paying someone to tend to this fan mail was such a clever move, because it really helped them build this very loyal fan base.
Very smart business move. Not even just smart, but a really great choice to employ a fan of the Beatles to do all of this, because she did it with so much heart. Like, she told stories in the film about how she'd feel bad when she couldn't fulfill a request, or she'd smudge a stamp on an autograph book and feel so bad about it, because she could put herself in the fans' shoes so easily. She had such a big heart to do this. Journalists would show up at her door asking for insider information on the Beatles, but she always refused. In turn, the guy's loyalty to Frida deepened. At a gig one night, she hung out with the Moody Blues staff in their dressing room next door. When she returned to the Beatles, a little drunk, to get some things signed, John got jealous and tried to fire her, but the other three stuck up for her, saying she could still work for them. Soon realizing his mistake and the sheer amount of letters he'd been dealing with, John was one of the favorites, he tried to backtrack. But Frida decided to have some fun with the situation. She made John beg her on his hands and knees to take him back. "I'll meet you halfway," John said, and he got down on one knee. To have John Lennon get down on one knee was a dream come true for so many girls in the 60s. In reality, Frida's dream job was many sleepless nights and fending off hordes of girls who turned up everywhere the guys went. It could be quite overwhelming. In a 2014 profile in Executive Support magazine, she described when, at the height of Beatlemania, she considered running off to be a nanny in Greece. Quote, "Then I thought, so many people want my job at the moment, and, hello, I'm getting paid for it, when they'll do it for nothing. So I thought, no, I'll stick at this and see how long it lasts."
Frida and the guys weren't as close after the firm moved to London. They were more famous than ever, and they were getting married and starting their own families. Good old Frida stayed in the Beatles' inner world, though. As the guys' personal style changed, growing out their facial hair and wearing lavish designs by Granny Takes a Trip, so did Frida's. Through the late 1960s, she wore psychedelic printed dresses and grew her bubble hairdo out long. She graduated to Epi's old office in Whitechapel, which she ran the fan club out of. She took issue with how much misinformation was going around about the guys. In an attempt to set the record straight, Frida began writing her Beatles monthly newsletter. She published updates on the guys' lives, wishing them a happy birthday, congratulating them on their marriages and children, and reporting recording sessions and trips. She occasionally had to remind fans that yes, Paul is still alive, Paul is not dead. She even reported on passport photos and dentist appointments. After all, the Beatles' world back then was one big family. Amidst the firestorm of the Beatles in 1968, their trip to India and falling out with the Maharishi, John's affair with Yoko Ono, and the very public divorce from Cynthia, Jane Asher breaking off her engagement to Paul on live television, and rumors of a Lennon-McCartney feud, Frida used Beatles Monthly to plead for the guys' privacy. Touring grew increasingly unsafe for the Beatles. After an incident in the Philippines when Paul innocently turned down a lunch with the dictator's wife, they had to flee for their lives. Things got dicey in the States after John's little bigger-than-Jesus thing. A bumpy ride out of a gig in a meat truck was their final straw, and in August of 1966, the Beatles quit touring. As the guys grew up and found their own paths in life, Epi found he had a diminishing role to the Beatles. His professional put-together veneer slipped as he became addicted to drugs. Those close to him feel he turned to substances to cope with money problems and his sexuality. Being gay was illegal in Britain until July of 1967. Even then, being outed would have been a huge blow to one's reputation. Brian was frequently the victim of extortionists who threatened to out him to the press or loved ones. In August of 1967, just after the release of Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band, John, Paul, and George attended one of the Maharishi seminars at the Hilton Hotel. Ringo skipped as his second child was only 5 days old. The very next day, August 25th, all four Beatles, plus Mick Jagger, Marianne Faithfull, and infamous Beatles hanger-on Magic Alex, left on a train for the Maharishi's course in Wales. On August 27th, the Beatles got a phone call. Brian Epstein had suddenly passed away of an overdose. This was devastating to the guys. Epi was their father figure in a lot of ways, having guided them through a crucial period of their professional and personal lives. They weren't just left without a manager, they were grieving a true friend. John was especially distraught. He was always the closest to Epi. When press shoved microphones in his face, asking invasive questions, he froze up. George took over for him. In wake of Epi's death, the Beatles turned to their new spiritual leader for answers. "He's only passed on. It's all right, really," the Maharishi told them. Later, Paul said, quote, "It was stunning because we were off on this finding the meaning of life journey, and there he was, dead." Frida didn't find out about Epi's passing until slightly later. Her phone line at the time was having issues. Whoever was supposed to notify her eventually figured out to call her neighbor, and finally she received the news. She was devastated as well. The only words she could say were, quote, "Where do we go from here? It was a complete shock. Epi wasn't just her boss for 6 years. He became family. While the media carried out the narrative that Brian's overdose was a suicide, Frida doesn't believe this.
In retrospect, Brian's passing was the first sign of trouble for the Beatles. He was the center of their world and the glue keeping four very different personalities together. The guys tried for a time to manage themselves. They soon found they were much better artists than entrepreneurs. Out of respect for Epi, the Beatles carried out the last projects he organized for them, Yellow Submarine and Magical Mystery Tour. Blink and you'll miss it, but you can see Frida on the bus behind Ringo and next to Magic Alex. Of course, without Epi around, productions of both films were a disaster. About her time on set of Magical Mystery Tour, Frida said, quote, "I should have gone for 2 weeks, but it was that crazy, and I left after a week. During one scene, I had to go into a little tent 36 times, and after the 36th time, I thought I'd had enough of this." But Magical Mystery Tour was very much Paul's concept. It became one of his attempts to keep the only band he ever knew together. In late 1967, the guys cobbled together Apple Corps to protect their money. It soon fell into chaos. Neil Aspinall was made executive, and he said so himself that he had no idea what he was doing. George described, quote, "Every weirdo in the country headed to Savile Row and got Office Space by John and Yoko. The Hare Krishnas, the Hells Angels, the Diggers, everybody was in there." About the office, Frida said, quote, "When Apple first opened, it was great. The fun, the madness, and all different nationalities in the press office, people didn't act as if they were working in an office or a business. Things were only getting crazier with no management. The Apple Records announcement on The Tonight Show was a time and a half. Johnny Carson was out that night, and the substitute host didn't know which Beatle was which. John called it the most embarrassing thing he'd ever been a part of. The guys were throwing money at ventures that just could not make any profit. Apple Films, Magic Alex running Apple Electronics, the embattled Apple Boutique facing issues from city council, theft, and poor management, lost a whopping $3.7 million in today's money. Money struggles accented the guys' personal differences and made recording the White Album nothing short of hellish. It was so bad that producer George Martin left to go on vacation and engineer Jeff Emmerich quit. Frida's life was changing too. While the guys were away in India, she got married. It was then that she finally moved to Castle Street and into Brian's brother Clive Epstein's old office to be closer to Apple. Also in 1968, Derek Taylor replaced Tony Barrow as the Beatles' new press officer. Derek's press releases are actually unhinged. I highly recommend you seek them out. Like Neil, he was quite an eccentric guy. When asked about him on the Fans on the Run podcast last year, Frida said, quote, "I loved Derek. I think everybody loved Derek. I don't know anybody who didn't like Derek."
While this casual, chaotic, disorganized environment led to some truly special endeavors like the White Album and the Rooftop Concert,
Lars Land and I really think there should be a comedy film about Apple Corps.
I would love to watch that.
I would love to sell that idea. Think about it. There's Mal Evans, Neil Aspinall, and Derek Taylor. You got Magic Alex running around, Frida, Chris O'Dell, the Apple Scruffs, the Fool pop in every once in a while. It's madness.
It would be great. Honestly, that would be such a fun film. This atmosphere was the perfect opportunity for Alan Klein to slip in. Klein was finishing his turn with the Rolling Stones, in which he allegedly withheld over $17 million from them, left them in financial ruin after not paying their taxes, and through clever legal loopholes, swindled away their entire back catalog. Even the stuff they recorded before Klein was around.
This is insane.
The fact that that is possible is baffling to me.
He's like a cartoon supervillain.
Yes.
And when he tried to steal My Sweet Lord from George, this guy.
For the Apple film, he would need to have this like melody whenever he enters, this like villain tune playing. Glyn Johns, engineer for the Stones and producer of the Beatles Get Back project, knew Klein was bad news. He'd seen it firsthand. So had Paul, who was trying to get his brother-in-law to manage the Beatles' affairs instead. But no one else saw the red flags they did. Brian's death was the first crack in the Beatles' foundation. Their fallout with the Maharishi, money woes, and John's messy personal life were added stressors. But it was Alan Klein and Paul's rightful refusal to accept him as manager that ultimately did the Beatles in. In April 1970, after Klein meddled with Paul's solo album's release date in favor of Let It Be, Paul announced he was leaving the band. This effectively broke up the Beatles. Frida tried to save face. When asked about her job security, she cheerily say, quote, "There's still four members." Inside, she knew the truth. Her days at Apple were numbered. In due time, Klein completely took over Apple, replacing everyone with his own people. But for 2 years after the Beatles broke up, Frida kept responding to the guy's fan mail.
That's dedication. I can only imagine the influx of letters she got when the Beatles announced their breakup.
Yeah, and I also think it is so incredibly strong to not get discouraged by the fact that, like, whenever you're done with a stack of 100 letters, there are 100 more, and it's probably all quite heartbreaking because everyone was so sad about the Beatles breaking up, and you have to go through that and over that over and over again. So I feel like it really came from the place of her being such a big fan and what she would have wanted in this situation.
She would have comforted thousands of fans.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
In 1972, when Frida was 27, she discovered she was pregnant. She'd been trying to start a family for a while. Mothers tended to be much younger in the 60s and 70s, but back then it was near impossible to be both a working woman and a mother. After much contemplation, she broke the news to Neil Aspinall, George, and Ringo that she wouldn't be returning from maternity leave. Seeing the direction Apple was headed in and the direction she wanted her life to go, she handed in her notice. For real this time. At George's behest, the fan club ended with Frida's departure, but not before one final newsletter. Frida took the last batch of fan mail home with her, slowly answering it across 3 years. Though her son Timothy always urged her to, Frida has not written a book. For a long time, she outright refused to speak about her time with the Beatles. She even shrugged off the topic with her own children. Quote, "I was just a secretary then, and funny enough, I'm still a secretary now, and who would want to hear the secretary's story?" But when Timothy passed away and Frida's grandchildren were born, she had a change of heart. Instead of a book, she chose to participate in Ryan White's 2013 documentary, Good Old Frida. To date, it's the only comprehensive account of Frida's life. Good Old Frida was distributed by Magnolia Pictures, who've also produced films about Big Star, The Band, The Wrecking Crew, Muscle Shoals Studio, Ken Kesey's Acid Tests, Danny Fields, Joan Jett, Joan Baez, Brian Jones, and most recently, Catching Fire, the story of Anita Pallenberg. Basically, when we see the Magnolia logo before a documentary, we know we're going to enjoy it. Until Good Old Frida, Frida hadn't made a cent from her time with the Beatles. She might be very wealthy today had she kept an auction off all her letters, autographs, and memorabilia from her Beatles days. Save for a couple scrapbooks and albums, she gave it all away to Apple Scruffs in the 1970s. Frida's daughter, Rachel, said, quote, "My mother has never played the fame game. If she had, things would be completely different now. And she might not be working 6 days a week, 9 till 5 at night, very stressed, when other people have retired and she hasn't got that joy. It's true, Frida worked as a secretary for over 50 years, but she hasn't forgotten her connection to the band she loved so dearly." When it came time for the Beatles fan club holiday message to be re-released on vinyl, Frida brought her copies of the singles to Apple to create master recordings.
"I'm George Harrison. Nobody else has said anything yet about our fan club secretaries, Anne Collingham and Betty, you know, Rose. Not to mention Frida Kelly in Liverpool.
Get out, Frida!
So on behalf of us all, I'd just like to say a great big thank you to Anne, Bettina and Frida for all the hard work they've done. And we just hope you can go on pleasing you for a long time. Because it's your reaction to our records that really matters."
Save for a couple of interviews and an appearance at the 2024 Chicago Beatle Fest, Frida keeps quiet today. She's mum about her dating history as well, as it may include a Beatle or two. Though her contact with the guys diminished over the years, Frida was involved in the making of embattled Brian Epstein biopic Midas Man. It's been out in Europe for a while now, but it's only now getting a US distribution. Only last year did Frida finally auction off some Beatle gear. In September, her photographs from the Beatles at Odd Spot Club in Liverpool, ticket stubs, and copies of the fan club Christmas singles were all sold.
I was invited to the Midas Men premiere, both in England and then again in the US, and I'm so sad because I could never make it, and I'm still a little heartbroken about that. I would love to see it, but I hope that they will soon release a DVD copy or something for me to get my hands on, because I feel like Brian Epstein is this incredible person. Without him, the Beatles would have never had the kind of career that they had. Maybe they would have broken up way sooner. No one knows, but I feel like he was, in a lot of ways, the glue that kept them together and the one that kept everything rolling. So I cannot wait to hear his story.
Not all of his business dealings were great. He did kind of get the Beatles tied up with United Artists Recordings, with the movies and all that. But he was a good manager. So many artists in the 60s were taken advantage of by terrible managers who took all their money, took their albums in some case, took their master recordings. Brian had their best interests at heart.
I feel like all the mistakes he made was from him being inexperienced and not from him not wanting the best for them.
When Frida left Apple, she said she was excited to lead a normal life again and become a housewife. That's exactly what she's doing today, simply enjoying being a mother and grandma. She still adores the Beatles, but she also likes modern groups too, like Coldplay, The Killers, and Noel Gallagher's High Flying Birds. She doesn't care for Liam much. Don't worry, Frida does still see Paul and Ringo from time to time. As for her favorite Beatles song, she couldn't possibly choose. But on Fans on the Run, she did name I'm Only Sleeping. Though she might not think so, Frida Kelly was essential to the Beatles' success. Sure, her no-nonsense attitude and devotion earned her one of the highest-ranking jobs a woman could have in the music industry at the time. And what's a great band without a fan club? But it was Frida's values and heart that gained the trust of the biggest band in the world and thousands of their fans. Her discretion earned the guys friendship and upheld their privacy. Her devotion made her an idol to young members of the fan club. And her humility earns her a very special place in the Beatles canon. She shows us just what it means to be a fan, and just how much a girl's love and devotion can shape rock and roll history. Here's to you, good old Frida. Thanks for tuning in to this episode of Unveiling the Legends, Dolls of the 60s and 70s. We hope you enjoyed our journey through a magical mystery tour of the life and career of Frida Kelly.
As always, we're Emma
and Abby,
your hosts, and we're thrilled to have you with us on this groovy adventure. Remember, the spirit of these trailblazing ladies lives on in each one of us, inspiring us to embrace our individuality, creativity, and passion for change.
If you like what you heard, don't forget to subscribe to, rate, and review the show on your favorite streaming platform. Your feedback means the world to us, and it helps others discover the magic of these legendary dolls.
As always, we'd like to thank special friend of the show, Michael Teggio, for the wonderful intro song. Until next time, keep the music loud, the fashion groovy, and the spirit of the 60s and 70s alive in your hearts.
Peace,
love,
and rock and roll.